Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Megan Gorman, and I will be your host. Today on the show, we have a guest that I'm incredibly excited about. Ram Lieber has been on the New York Times Money Columnist since 2008, and he has spent his entire career writing about personal finance. He's written the New York Times best-selling book, The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. And recently, he decided to tackle one of the biggest costs that many Americans face, the cost of going to college. And so in January of 2021, his new book, The Price You Pay for College, an entirely new roadmap for the biggest financial decision your family will ever make, came out. It's a phenomenal book, and I suggest to all of our listeners, whether you have children or you're like me and just have friends and family with children, that you should read it. So Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I have to tell you, as soon as I saw your book, I knew we had to have you on the show. It's an incredible book, very, very insightful about the college decision process and the financial planning that goes into it. And especially for me, my two best friends right now have 17-year-old daughters going through the process, and it's not easy. There's a lot in your book to go over, and I figured let's break the interview up into three parts. Where we are and how we got here, understanding some key numbers and stats, and then some just general tips for parents who are trying to navigate this. So I think the threshold question, I think this is something that many American parents ask themselves is it possible to get an affordable education in the United States today in 2021?
Much depends on how we define affordable. You know, so where to start with this? I think one of the things that gets very complicated very quickly is that a college education could cost anywhere from zero to $350,000. And that's after taxes. If you have a traditional age kid, you know, going to pursue a four-year residential degree right now. And that price can be zero for rich people. It can be zero if you're going to the United States Service Academies. It can be zero if your child qualifies for a full ride, you know, based on athletic prowess. It can be zero if your child qualifies for a full ride at one of, you know, dozens of institutions that give full academic scholarships, including room and board. There can sometimes, although not always and mostly not, be a disconnect between your ability to pay and what your bottom line price might actually be. So this is often surprising to people. And, you know, they think that there isn't enough equity built into the system, but it's taken decades to evolve in this way. And I guess the most important thing for people to understand is that, you know, the list price is not the net price. And so much goes into what you might actually pay. And only part of that equation is your ability to do so.
We do hear those people who get the full rides, but that seems almost like a unicorn story. You rarely actually hear that in real life. But I think the thing is, what I found so unique in the book, there were a lot of numbers in there on the cost of college. But this seems like the first time anyone has pulled them all together to create the story of education in the United States. Is that a fair assessment?
I'm glad you think so. We have a basic problem here when it comes to parents who are approaching this process, expecting to be able to easily find the kind of information that you can find when you're shopping for a car or shopping for a cell phone plan. This thing, right, a residential undergraduate education costs many, 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 many multiples, you know, of those other things that we just ticked off. But it turns out that there is actually not all that much, you know, really good consumer information for people who are trying to shop in an organized fashion. And so part of what I was trying to do with The Price You Pay for College is help people understand who pays what and why, how the system of financial aid and discounting works and evolved, so that people can begin the process, you know, knowing which questions to ask, what the possibilities are, and also, you know, how to prepare themselves to be realistic about what the bottom line price might actually be.
Yeah. And I think the book does that very, very well. I think it gives you sort of all the resources or where to go if you have more questions on top of what's in there. The best way to understand for a lot of Americans on how this became a problem in paying for college is to get a good understanding of how higher education has evolved over the past 50 years, because the system has changed and it's different depending on when you went to college. So give us a brief history of how it's evolved.
Well, let's talk about what hasn't changed, because the fact of the matter is that for people who are paying for a residential undergraduate education today for their teenagers, they will find that there actually has not been all that much innovation in how the education is delivered, how kids experience it, and what they do, you know, after class and on the weekends. It hasn't changed all that much because I'm not sure we really want it to. Now, you know, the last 2 years have been sort of their own thing, right? But we've actually learned a lot in those last 2 years about the limitations of online education and or the demand for online education among traditional age undergraduates. What's changed a ton, though, is the costs and the pricing and the way the gears churn and the mechanisms work behind the scenes, right? So back in the day, even for some of us who are old enough to be sending our kids to college right now, you could actually reasonably expect to work your way through college, right? When I started in the late 80s, it was still possible at state universities, not so much at, you know, full pay, full price private ones, but it was possible at state universities still to work your way through college, right? Mm-hmm. If you work 40, 50 hours a week in the summer and 10 to 20 hours a week during the year, you could pull it off, especially if you got a little bit of financial aid, if you got a few grants along the way, or, you know, maybe took out, you know, a reasonable amount of loans. Now that's not something you can do. And when we talk about this, you know, we should, you know, talk about both what's happened with state universities and, you know, pricing and discounts there and also private ones. With the state ones, it is largely the story of state legislatures decreasing the amount of subsidy, green piles of cash money that they toss over to the state university systems. When you experience the kind of recession like the one that we experienced in 2007, 2008, 2009, one of the easiest things that a state can do is just, you know, cut the money that's given to the university and ask the parents to pick up the slack through, you know, their earnings or through additional debt. And when you parcel that out over, you know, tens of thousands of students, and then you stick it to the, you know, parents who are coming from outside of the state and to international students, it starts to feel like a reasonable amount of money. That's a difficult thing to restore. Politically, it's a difficult thing to put back, right? So prices go up over there for those reasons. Now, over on the side of the private universities, one of the big things that's happened there, and the publics have been affected by this too, but, you know, when you charge more, as the privates do, people expect more. You know, what do they expect? Well, upper middle class families expect their children to live in the manner to which they've become accustomed, right?
Yes.
And so when you ask colleges about the so-called amenities wars, right? You know, the nicer dorms and the bigger gyms, you know, how much money is being spent on those things. You know, I think it's possible to exaggerate the budgetary mm-hmm. effects of those, but there are costs to upgrading facilities and providing better ones than existed a generation ago. The colleges look at you cross-eyed, and, you know, I was in dozens of offices of university presidents asking them about this, and they said, what are you looking at me for? It's the parents who raise the kids this way. And the kids arrive here, you know, expecting to have access to, you know, blazing fast internet and a gym like the one, you know, that their parents had built in the garage, right? And,
yeah, exactly.
And, you know, and food like the parents bring home from, you know, Whole Foods or, you know, or pick up at Chipotle. And, you know, if we don't provide that, all those tuition dollars are going to go someplace else. And then the school ceases to exist. So what do you expect us to do? This is a market, right? We can't say to the consumer, no, actually, what's really best for you is an experience that's much lower to the ground. You know, it's hard to argue with that. And then the other thing that's gone on is that, you know, there are way more regulations than there used to be a generation ago. And those regulations exist for a good reason, right? I mean, we want our daughters to have equal access to playing fields. We want our Black and brown children not to be discriminated against. We want our first generation children to have access to the kinds of resources that they will need to help them get to and through school, because we actually have a completion crisis in the United States. There are all sorts of people who come to college and don't finish, right? So right. for all of that stuff to be implemented and to work the way that I think that all of us want it to, we need administrators more than we had a generation ago. And those administrators are not 24 years old earning $45,000 a year. You know, they're 44 years old and they have master's degrees and they deserve to be compensated. And if those people weren't there, I think we would be complaining about that, right? Because then our kids wouldn't have the things that we need and the schools won't be providing the resources that they should to follow all the rules and make things fair.
You laid out really, really well that things have evolved so much over the past 50 years and what we asked for school. And I laugh as you say some of this because schools have come to cater to what people are looking for. But when parents are focusing on the price tag and students are focusing on the price tag, they go through this process. Do they walk away satisfied from what they experience, from the process to what they get from the colleges? I mean, do you feel it's one of those things as a consumer, you walk away saying that was a good deal? Or is it just a rite of passage?
You know, that's really a great question. And no one's put it to me quite in that way. Because I, you know, as a reporter, and I think people who question me about the book tend to focus on student satisfaction, right? Like what's happening to the trajectory of that 22-year-old's life, to their career, to their earning, to their happiness, right? What is the return in terms of friendship? But people don't usually ask me about whether the parents themselves are satisfied when the kid is 22 or when the kid is 27 or when the kid is 32, whether the parents feel like they got their money's worth. You know, I think it would be helpful to have, you know, really rigorous survey research about this. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, Consumer Reports is not out there asking parents of 32-year-olds how they feel about the $272,000 that they spent on that person's undergraduate education. We don't actually know. I can't answer your question because it's so good, right? And so that's crazy. That's crazy that we have no idea what the answer to that question is. One of the biggest, and I would argue the most impactful, you know, consumer, you know, decision that we'll ever make in our lifetime, if we are parents who are able and willing to pay for this, the fact that we have so little customer satisfaction data is astonishing, frankly.
The other thing that I have found over the course of my career and working with families is the families are selective on who wants to actually bring the child into the financial decision-making process. And that always surprises me because it's so expensive. And, you know, I'm very fortunate. I work with families who are able to save, right? They're in that unique group, but then they sort of keep it like wrapped up in a black box and don't involve the child in, look, this is a $200,000 decision. This is how the money works. Did you find in looking at some of this research, there was more satisfaction from students if they were involved in the financial process? Or is that also not something that's looked at as much?
I can't point to any data on it. But what I can tell you is that one of the reasons I wrote The Price You Pay for College in the first place was that I was seeing an increasing volume of communications from readers, from friends of friends, just, you know, from neighbors, from the ether, right, each spring, from parents who had not even really realized themselves what they were going to have to pay, how few discounts would be available, had not really reckoned with the hard questions that they needed to ask themselves until it was the spring of senior year. It was too late to do anything about it. And they had to have some very difficult conversations with some very tearful children. So the parents themselves had not sorted it out in time, let alone included the kids in the process. And my feeling about this is that you as an individual parent, or you with your spouse, if you have one, or your ex, if you've got one of those, certainly need to get your head screwed on straight, individually or collectively, figure out what you might be able to pay if financial trends continue apace, and what you might be willing to pay or borrow, and whatever gap may exist between those two things. And then sit down and have a conversation with your eighth grader, you know, when they finish middle school, and say, look, this is where we think we're going to be. And we feel like it's only fair for you to know what sort of financial constraints, if any, we might be operating in or within 4 years from now. Because if you don't know, you know, what you might be able to pay, how do you know what kind of, you know, academic or scholarship goals you should be shooting for? It's like you're playing a game without really knowing how it's going to be judged at the end or whether you're going to be eligible for certain prizes. I'm not saying there's something wrong with any family that like can't pay $300,000 or can't pay $100,000 or won't pay $100,000 for a flagship state university. You have nothing to apologize for if you have done your best. And you should just explain that to your kid so they know what kind of resources, if any, they're going to have to work with. And then then you can make a plan.
One story I have is I have a client whose son, they put money in a 529 and an UTMA. And every year he'd come to a meeting and we'd go through performance. And then when he was looking at schools, we ran analysis. And there were some schools, the 529 would cover it all. Some schools, the mix of the both plans would cover it all. And some schools, he'd use both the 529 and the UTMA and have to take loans. And he looked at me and he's like, why would I do that? And it was an interesting problem-solving process. But I think to your point, I think parents aren't bringing kids in enough to talk about it. But I think it's also, it's a little bit overwhelming for the parent to make the financial decision, much less the child. So I think that takes us to FAFSA, because I think that's one of the areas where parents are like, what is this? I will tell you, and you've been on the FAFSA site, it's a complex computer program to try to enter data into. I mean, I sit with clients and I'm like, how do you, like, this is hard. You talk about in the book, it's confusing, but really it's also quirky. You talk about these quirks, and some of the quirks you talk about is that there's no adjustments if you live in a place like San Francisco, where I am now, or New York City. There's no adjustments if the parents have student loan debt, which I thought was interesting because we're going to start to get millennial children. Millennials, their children are going to start coming to school. So is the FAFSA a realistic process for today's day and age?
No, but it's important not to overstate what FAFSA is and what it stands for. One thing that, you know, people could do to just kind of bring themselves, you know, back from the ledge is just remind themselves that the FAFSA form is just a way to ration federal aid. It's not like the bottom line price that you will be expected to pay anywhere. Right? All it does is try to figure out if you're eligible for Pell Grants because you have low enough income and what sort of federal student loans and, you know, federal work study programs might you be eligible for when you get to college. And then the schools themselves take the FAFSA information and do with it what they will. Some colleges and universities, particularly on the state side, will use that FAFSA data, not ask for anything else, and then use it in whatever way they choose to make their own decisions about what sort of discounts they may or may not offer to your family based on financial need. Now, that's before they make any decisions about academic merit, which is something that FAFSA doesn't address, but, you know, gets to the data that comes in with the rest of your application. Then when it comes to private schools, well, you know, the 300 or so most rejective private schools have their own form that they use with even more data called the CSS profile, right? And then they take the information that comes from there and run their own proprietary formula and, you know, tell you what they're willing to give you in the way of a discount based on your financial need before they suck in all of the academic and extracurricular data and maybe make you an even better offer based on the supposed merit of your child, right? So, you know, if your head is spinning at this point, I'm sorry. That's just how it works. I wish it was different. I'm angry about it too, but we need to learn to work within the system that we have before we can beat it and blow it up, right? And so that's the system. You often have to fill out two of these like super complicated forms, do each of them four times over 4 years. And then and only then will the school make its proprietary offer to you, which is, you know, based on this data, but built on a formula that only it understands and it may not explain to you.
And you sort of say in the book that, you know, there are a group of people who pay full freight to go to school, but that 89% of the population, there was a survey that found that most people pay about $23,900. That's usually the cost per year that a lot of them pay. Is that the right data?
Yeah. So it depends on private or public. At the private institutions, the vast, vast majority of people are getting some kind of a discount. And sometimes it's based on your financial need, on your income and your assets. Sometimes it's based on in theory at least, on merit, on your kid's performance. And sometimes, often actually, it's just an algorithm sucking in all of that data and trying to predict what you might be willing to pay if you are a $220,000 earning family in Lafayette, California, you know, whose kid has a 1420 on the SATs and an A-minus average. So that's both, you know, how it works and how it doesn't work.
What is the difference between financial aid, discounts, and merit? Because those terms are used a lot in the education process, but I don't think they're always clearly defined.
The term discount is just me trying to use an overarching and somewhat bratty word to describe what's actually going on here. There's the list price, and then there's the discount they're going to offer you, and then there's the net price that they're going to try and get you to pay. And that, to me, is the best way to think about this broadly. And the way that the schools divide up their, you know, discounting processes is that there's the discount that you may or may not get offered from the financial aid office. And that is based on your demonstrated financial need, according to your income mostly, and your assets sometimes, as demonstrated through that FAFSA form and the CSS profile form that we were talking about before. Then merit aid is different, you know, kind of parallel system that's run by the admissions office, where in theory, at least, you know, they're looking at your grades, they're looking at your scores if you provide them, they're looking at your extracurricular activities. And that's all being, you know, sucked up and sucked in by an algorithm that the admissions office is renting from a consulting firm that uses a whole bunch of data, including that academic data, to try and make you an offer that you can't and won't refuse, that is just a flat discount off the list price. They refer to it, you know, as a merit scholarship, but in many instances, every single admitted student is being offered that discount. Those discounts vary. Your discount will generally be higher if you are a much, you know, better than average student at that institution. But sometimes institutions have, you know, weird priorities in any given year where they're, you know, trying to attract more upper middle class students from the upper Midwest to Southern Methodist University. And so, you know, if you're applying from Minneapolis and you're applying from New Orleans, all things being equal demographically and statistically, you might get a much better offer if you're from Minneapolis, because SMU really wants to compete harder for kids from, you know, the far north of the United States. And you can't predict that that might be going on in any given year. You just kind of have to roll with it.
One question I've had is, you know, I'm from a small town. I live in the Bay Area. And what's always fascinated me is the extreme contrast on resources that parents have. So in the Bay Area, like New York City, a lot of the metropolitan areas, there's coaches, there's programs. I mean, you are trained to apply for colleges. And then you can go to small towns and the kids are doing the applications on their own. Maybe the guidance counselor looks at them, but there's a lot less engagement. First of all, is that a fair process? Is that, you know, does it, how much does having all of those resources impact your chance of getting into the college you want and getting the aid that you need?
No, it's not fair. The more resources you have, the more advantage you have, which is, you know, true in this instance and, you know, true in a world and in a country that's practically governed by inequality. And so parents, families tend to get a little confused about this, because there is one point in this process where disadvantage in certain instances may actually give you an edge. And that is when you are applying to some of the most rejective, well-resourced schools in the United States, where if you are a first-generation student, if you are a person of color, if you have overcome very long odds to put yourself in a position where those schools think that you can get to and through there, they may let you in and, you know, give you a full ride or close to it. And the kid from the private school, you know, in Palo Alto, you know, who's white and female, because young women are more highly represented, you know, in the 100 most rejected schools than men are, you may not have an edge at that instance, right? And so, you know, there are all of these affluent white people wringing their hands out of public, you know, afraid to ask the question in public, but asking in private, you know, is the system now rigged against, you know, affluent white girls? The answer is no. affluent white girls have all of the advantages between the ages of 0 to 17 and a half, right? To get into the great public school system in Palo Alto and to have all the tutoring for the SAT and to join the club sports teams and to have, you know, parents who are not working 90 hours a week trying to make a living or, you know, trying not to get deported or whatever the situation might be. And then at that one point, there may be a slight admissions edge in certain colleges and universities, you know, given to a person of color or a person of color who is lower income. And then you get to college, right? Then, you know, the affluent kids have all the advantages again. They can live closer to campus. They can take the unpaid internship. They have the sort of cultural capital to know that they can just, you know, barge into a professor's office and, or, you know, demand something of an administrator, right? And so that question can lead to complicated places and to, you know, uncomfortable conversations. But I'm trying to encourage people to have them, particularly when there's this, you know, growing sense among affluent white people that like the system is rigged against them now at the most rejective institutions.
That's helpful. That's very helpful. I will say before we get to the final part of our interview, I wanted to bring up something you allocated about 5 pages of your book to, and it's a topic that's near and dear to me, and that is women's colleges. I'm a Bryn Mawr grad. and many of the reasons that you talk about in the book is some of the reasons I went to a women's college. And I think a lot of women do, right? Which is the ability to be in leadership, to be present, and also for women in STEM. So are you seeing trends where people are thinking more towards single-sex institutes for their daughters? Were the benefits surprising to you in doing your research?
I don't know that I can point to trend lines where, say, you know, the growth in applications at the 10 or 20 most rejected women's colleges are, you know, equal to the growth in applications at their, you know, logical co-ed peers. I haven't actually done that work. I'm just trying to get people to put one of those schools on the list. If you have a daughter who is looking at colleges and may not be inclined to take a look at these places, just take a look, right? Just stop in and visit. Because in a world that, you know, still has way too much gender bias, I think these schools do offer an edge, particularly for STEM students. And it's worth taking a hard look and asking some hard questions, you know, about gender at any institution that you're considering, co-ed or not.
So in our last few minutes, I want you to give us your best piece of advice for a few different groups of parents. First off, parents who have children who are rising seniors, what should be priority here?
Well, have you stopped and asked yourself the basic fundamental underlying question here, right? Which is, what exactly are we shopping for? Like, what does college actually mean to us? Is college for the education? Is college for the kinship, right? For the acquisition of mentors and a peer network and a group of friends who will hoist you on their shoulders and carry you through life? Is it about the credential? And if so, what kind of credential are you seeking? Is this a ticket to a seat at the CPA exam and an auditing job at PricewaterhouseCoopers? Is this just a way station on the way to taking over a family business? Or are you a family of social workers with a budding investment banker or software developer in your house who only wants to shoot for the moon and end up with venture capital funding from Sand Hill Road at the age of 24, or, you know, wants to be working at Goldman Sachs and not Salt Lake City, so Goldman Sachs, like investment banking training, Goldman Sachs in New York City at the age of 22. Because if that's what they want and you're determined for them to have it, then you probably should be shooting for Wharton undergrad or Stanford or MIT or Caltech and be thinking about, you know, what it's going to take to pay for that or get the aid that will be necessary. You know, it's only in relatively limited circumstances where you can point either quantitatively or qualitatively to the fact that, you know, the $300,000 education may in fact be the difference that makes a difference.
And then for those who have young children, how early would you say they should get involved in planning this?
Yesterday, I'm not trying to stress people out. It's just a basic fact that, you know, the sooner you start saving, the more time that money has to compound, right? To, you know, grow on itself where the earnings are generating earnings. And the longer you do that for, the more choices you'll have in 20 years and the less pain you might experience. Now, I know that not everybody can do that, and I'm not shaming people who don't or haven't, but you know, the best time to start thinking about it financially is today.
And on that note, Ron, as we wrap up, please let people know where they can find you and, more importantly, where they can get your book.
Thank you. You can get my book at any independent bookstore in the United States of America. And if they don't have it in stock, they will be happy to order it for you. So that's the best place to get the book. It's available also online at, you know, all of the usual places where books are sold. And you can find me on the internet at ronlieber.com, where you can sign up for my email newsletter. And I'm on all of the usual social channels at Ron Lieber.
And now let's move on to the panel portion of our show. We have today on the panel our very own Barb Friedberg. How you doing, Barb?
Doing great, Megan. Happy to be here.
And we also have our moderator, our usual moderator, Kirk Chisholm. How are you doing today, Kirk?
Doing great, Megan. I like being in the hot seat today, so.
Yeah, it's fun trading off roles, isn't it?
It is.
And then our third panelist today, I'm really, really excited about. Today, we have Jack Wang on the show with us. And Jack has over 10 years of experience as a financial advisor, but specifically, he works at Innovative Advisory Group and focuses on financial aid and student loan planning. And so we thought he would be a great panelist on today's show. So Jack, welcome aboard.
Thanks so much, Megan. Thrilled to be here and thrilled to be part of the panel today.
I think let's start with a really broad question. And I'd like to just have each of you give me your quickest thoughts about it. But Ron's book talks about the cost of college and what it is, you know, what you have to pay and how much you should be prepared for. So from a philosophical standpoint, can you get a fair, affordable education in the United States today? And I'm going to actually start with you, Kirk.
You know, I struggle with this a lot, Megan. You know, I got two young boys and they're not college age. I probably still got another, you know, 5 years where I have to start thinking about it. But, you know, I struggle with this a lot because I know when my kids were born, I was talking to a buddy of mine. We thought it would be somewhere in their neighborhood of like $1 million for two kids to send them to college, which seems kind of ridiculous at the time. Now it maybe doesn't seem so ridiculous with the cost of college. Let's just say, hypothetically, I were to give each one of them $500,000 and say, would you go to college or could you put this $500,000 to work? I like to frame it in that way because that's effectively what you're doing. You're deciding whether, you know, that $500,000 is, as an example, maybe it's the wrong number, but let's just use that as an example, whether that is the right use of that money. Is it better to send them to college or can they make use of it starting a business or investing? I know we're going to talk about a lot of aspects of this, but I think just from the financial aspect, I've read a lot of places that colleges have a negative ROI or a negative return on investment, where it didn't used to be that way. So I struggle with that because I want my kids to have the college experience and, you know, not be left out because everyone else went. But the same point is that the most practical use of the money and, you know, can they get a better experience doing other things? So I do struggle with that. And I think it's something that I guess I'm on of two minds about it. I haven't come to a conclusion, but it's something that I'm definitely struggling with.
So Barb, any thoughts on, can you get an affordable education in this country?
Yes. And I believe that the idea of sending a student off to an expensive four-year college, private college, is an extreme luxury today. If my child was of college age at this point, I would seriously think about two-year community college, two-year state school, and doing something to having the child work while they go to school and look for scholarships, look for grants, look for any way to keep those costs down. Because yes, you do not have to have a college education today. And there's a lot of alternatives that make sense that are maybe more technical training type of jobs or educations or starting a business or something like that. But there is a lot of data that college graduates on average earn significantly more money over their lifetime than non-college graduates. I think there's an affordable way, and I think Jack will probably be able to weigh in on that even in more depth.
Right. That's why I had the two of you go first. Because Jack, I mean, you are knee deep in this on a daily basis. So from your vantage point as subject matter expert here, what do you think? Can you get an affordable education?
So the first part of your question, can you get an affordable education? The answer to that is yes. The sticker prices out there in the world can be very scary, with the most expensive colleges topping over $80,000 all in. And, you know, that's a lot of money. In fact, I sometimes jokingly tell people, like, do you want to help pay for college, or would you rather just buy your kid a sports car and just call it a day, right? Because the sports car is probably, like, the Ferrari is probably cheaper in some instances. However, the challenge is all of these other questions. It, you know, does college provide a positive ROI? Is it a quote-unquote good college? Is the price fair, quote-unquote? All of these other facets. And so this really transcends finances or a traditional quantitative ROI calculation, because in the college space, like many things in the financial space, there's egos and values and emotions and philosophies that really come into it. So what Kirk's perception is of affordable at a good college might be different than yours, Megan, might be different than Barb's, and certainly different than mine. So because of that, the whole system becomes very, very confusing. So if you ask the sort of the basic point, can you get an affordable college education? The answer to that is yes. But then once you add on all these other layers, it really confuses and, you know, messes up this whole situation, because then you have people who think, well, but if I send my kid to an Ivy League school and pay full sticker price, is that still considered affordable or fair or whatever, as opposed to sending them to a state college or perhaps going the community college route that Barbara talked about? These are the other factors that really come into play.
I think one of the things I would like to understand better, Jack, is looking at this, you know, a lot of times when you're working with clients, you come at it from the parent and child perspective. But take me to the other side of this. How do schools look at assessing applicants financially?
A couple of things that many people don't really keep in mind is that the majority of colleges in the United States, and there's over 4,000, they're either public institutions like University of, you know, California and the various campuses, or University of Massachusetts, what have you, or they're private colleges, but the vast majority of colleges are nonprofit. That doesn't necessarily mean that they don't operate in a somewhat profit motive type of strategy. And what I mean by that is, at the end of the day, you have to remember that colleges still have to be able to keep the lights on, right? And pay their faculty and add to amenities. And certainly, you know, like the dining experience these days and the quality of the food is really important. So when colleges look at students, they really look at it as, who are they trying to attract? You've heard the story of the well-rounded student. I have a friend who, a college admissions counselor, who really talks about that's really a myth. It's colleges are really looking for well-rounded student bodies. And so depending on who they're trying to attract, whether it's for certain majors, or certain types of students, or kids from a certain geography, they're going to use their financial resources and aid and scholarships and what have you to try and attract the types of students that they want to attract. And that can change year to year. So from a college perspective, most colleges don't have the big endowments like the Harvards and the Yales of the world. So they have to be very selective about how they deploy their resources, no different than anybody else, quite frankly, or any individual. So the real secret, if you will, is understanding that perspective and playing the game and understanding the game, that colleges will say, look, if we really want you, for whatever reason we want you, right? It could be that high academics, or it could be that you're a certain gender, or you go into a certain major or a combination thereof. That student who checks off the most boxes will tend to get the most aid of some sort, right? Scholarships, grants, or otherwise. Versus if you are a student who applies to a particular college and you're sort of one of the many, then you tend not to get a lot of aid. Parents often think like, well, if I do this, or if my kid does that, or whatever, we'll get a lot of aid. And that's not exactly true. And one of the unfortunate aspects of all of this is that there's very little price transparency. Everybody can quote it. In the news, I talked about how the scary sticker prices, you know, topping $80,000, right? And people have heard these horror stories like, oh my goodness, as Kirk said, like, hey, if I send my kids to college, this might cost me $500,000 or something. But the price that, and in sort of Ron's book, is the price that families truly pay is typically far less, but there's no advance notice in terms of how much you might pay. In some instances, it's kind of like airlines. You know, people sort of figured out that if you fly on certain days, and there's plenty of these websites that track airfares and whatever, so you can kind of play that game based on where you're flying and what time you're flying, the day, week you're flying stuff. Colleges kind of do the same thing with their students, again, based on what they're who they're trying to track. But there's no system to allow people to see that kind of pricing ahead of time. So with airlines, I could go onto a website and say, look, if I'm flying from Boston to LA next Tuesday, I can see what the prices are, say, next Tuesday versus if I fly next Wednesday. But there's no system sort of correspondingly for colleges. And so that's what scares a lot of people, is because now, you know, all the different kids at different colleges pay all different prices depending on their situation. But the only price that people can be certain of or those really scary sticker prices, which again, can top $80,000. And, you know, that's probably a very convoluted answer, but from the school's perspective, it's kind of how they designed the system, right? And to some ways, it kind of gives them a lot of advantages, unfortunately.
So Jack, I'm going to ask you a quick follow-up on that, which is, should you take each year that your child's in school and handle it differently? Because it sounds like each year you could potentially pay a different price.
You know, that's a great question. And to a certain extent, yes, there's all sorts of stories. And I run into this all the time, especially people who have graduated. Okay. And they'll look back at their college experience and they'll say, you know, I got a lot of aid the first year, but for some reason, you know, some of my aid disappeared the second year, or the third year, or whatever. So I ended up having to pay more or borrow more or whatever. Financial aid, which is what most people associate with college aid, right, and filling out the FAFSA form, is evaluated year to year at the majority of schools. So if your parents or if the student's finances change substantially, then aid can disappear during the course of those 4+ years. And so the cost of the family can go up. So it is a year to year process. Unlike merit aid, which is typically scholarships, right, for good grades and stuff, that has less to do with finances and just more about sort of maintaining grades or what have you, that tends to be a little bit steadier at most schools. But the other sort of wrinkle to this and why this makes it so difficult is because when colleges come forth with financial aid offers, it's like a negotiation. In that aspect, it's almost like kind of buying a car. There are plenty of colleges out there that will what's called front load their awards. They'll give you, Megan, more money, scholarships, grants, or whatever, in the first year to try and get you to go. So then you show up your freshman year, you do well, you make lots of friends, you know, you love it on campus, but then some of those aid items disappeared because they're only there for 1 year. And again, this is all about the college allocating their own resources. But now if you think about it as the student, you might not want to transfer because that's where all your friends are now. And you like your classes and you like your dorm. But from a financial perspective, now you're stuck. The college, from their perspective, they did enough to get you to go. And more than likely, you're going to stay because you like your friends, you like your classes, you like your dorm, you like your campus.
So they've hooked you in.
They've hooked you in.
You know, one of the things that we brought up on the interview with Ron was we talked so much about the experience leading up to college and the college experience, but what happens afterwards? Do people feel satisfied with what they paid? And Barb, you put your kids through college, correct?
Yes, I did.
So tell me, now that it's been some time, are you satisfied with how the experience went? Are you satisfied with what you paid for? What are your thoughts on it now that this is in the rearview mirror?
Well, first of all, we had a unique situation. Our daughter was a competitive athlete. Due to that and her strong academics, she got a very, very robust scholarship every year that cut the costs down 25%. So that was extremely helpful. And we started saving for college very young in a 529 plan. So we had built up quite a bit of funds to pay for her college. So that together, she got probably a private school education for the cost of a public school education. So am I satisfied on balance? Yes, I am absolutely satisfied. But we did some things that other people may not be able to do, which was invested a lot of time and money in her athletics in high school so that she obviously did the work to become an elite athlete to then qualify for the scholarship. And we started saving and investing very, very young. And so, yes, I am very satisfied with the path we took. I do not under any circumstances want to say this is the path everyone should take.
It's interesting that you bring that up because it was a unique experience based on your daughter's abilities plus sort of the time period she went to school. The past few years, there has been a lot of sort of scandal around this, right? With the college admission scandal. And so one of the things that we briefly talked about in the interview with Ron was, you know, are there ways to have advantages, right? In terms of working with coaches or college prep tutors or focusing on athletics. I sort of want to get, Jack, your take on this. I mean, where should parents be investing their money in getting their child ready for college?
That's a question that often comes up. And, you know, I typically work with families where the child is headed to college, right? Because otherwise they wouldn't need my service. But I can tell you that even of those families, you know, it is quite common for a high school senior to be looking at some expensive colleges and have no idea what they want to major in or why they should even go to college other than the fact that the parents went to college and it was always the expectation. So we can talk about, you know, strategies and savings and like Barb talked about saving a 529 plan. That's all well and good, but there's nothing wrong with taking a gap year or figuring that out. And so one of the strategies I often talk about is, hey, you know, figure out if college is, if your student, if your son or daughter is not just academically ready for college, but are they emotionally and socially ready for college? National data tells us that, you know, 25 to 33%, roughly a quarter to a third of all undergraduates each year transfer. And kids transfer for all sorts of reasons, but often it's because they couldn't necessarily handle being away from home for an extended period. And 40% of all undergraduates graduate with a degree from a school that is different than where they started. And knowing that, and knowing how transfers work, and now you're not necessarily getting out in 4 years, but you might have to take 5 or 6 because you have to retake certain classes because they didn't transfer, that's a huge financial cost. So one of the questions that I encourage families to ask is, okay, you know, we want our son or daughter to go to college, but is that really the right path? And is it the right path now, right? Or can it be the right path a year or two from now? You rather sort of get it right versus pigeonholing your student into this college path that they may not be ready for, which then can lead to some of the less than ideal outcomes afterwards.
Kirk, you have children. You're looking prospectively at having children in the college process. When you think about that and you're giving yourself advice for financial reasons, where are you going to spend your money? Where are you going to invest in the process?
You know, from my perspective, I'm planning as if I'm going to send them to college. And, you know, what that looks like 5, 10 years, who knows? But, you know, the plan is I'm planning as if I was sending him to college because I think anything else, it would just be silly in my mind. Now, the challenge is not only if they're going to go, which I think is probably more likely yes than no, but if I kind of think about it, how can I put them in the best position to get into a good school, be desirable for that school, and maybe even get some sort of aid or reduction in price? So I have these conversations a lot with parents because, you know, up in the Northeast, we're a little bit competitive and there's a ton of schools in the Boston area. So it's, even though there's a ton of schools, they're also really, you know, a lot of them are very good schools and competitive. So the question is like, how do you put them in a position to succeed? And as Jack said, it's not about being a well-rounded student. It's having a well-rounded student body, which I think is good insight for a lot of people. Because when I was going to college, it was like, hey, how could you be good at community service, good at sports, good at academics, and good at all these things? And I think now it sounds like, you know, being really good at one thing is more desirable. And I know from kids' sports that it's not like you can do three or four sports like when I was growing up. Now you pretty much pigeonholed into one because everyone else is hyper-competitive around here and they're focused on one sport. So your kid is kind of behind if they don't. I think generally it feels like things are going in the wrong direction. Like kids can't just be kids and enjoy themselves. Everything has to have a purpose, which I don't really like. There's a healthy balance. But I think if you're trying to get your kid into school, they have to find something that they really enjoy and that they can be good at. And I guess the way I'm looking at it is, how can I put my kid in a position, or my boys, so that they can be good at something and have a shot at getting into a decent college. Mention this side note, because I think this comes up a lot in conversation. And Jack alluded to it earlier, of parents have these high goals of getting their kid into Harvard or Yale or whatever Ivy League school that they want them to go. It may not necessarily be the best choice. So one of my friends went to Harvard and I had this conversation with him 2 weeks ago. And he said, you know, everyone has this goal of getting their kid into Harvard. He's like, I know so many people that went to Harvard that were just life failures. Like, getting into Harvard is probably the worst thing for them. And it wasn't a knock on Harvard itself, because Harvard's obviously a good institution, but it's just a knock on, like, the goal is not getting them into college. You know, the goal is to have a happy and productive child in life. And for some people, that may be a good outlet to get them into a top school, but some people, it may be just getting a good education. I went to a liberal arts college. I wouldn't say it was worth the money that we spent. I think it was a good experience. I met a lot of good people, but I think the experience was really what we paid for, because look, Google wasn't a thing when I was in college. It is now. You can learn almost anything you want online. You don't need to go to school for that. Now, if you're going into medicine, if you're going to law or engineering or some sort of something that requires a specialized knowledge, then it might be required. But liberal arts, I'm kind of on the fence of, like, is college really the right place? Or are you just sending your kids to, you know, a four-year summer camp? So that's kind of how I feel about it. It's like, it's not, you know, if my kids are going for a specific purpose, then absolutely, they're definitely going to college. If they're going to learn about, you know, underwater basket weaving or philosophy or something that they can learn by themselves, I'm not sure if that's really the best place. So I guess that's kind of how I'm thinking about it.
One of the things that parents really have or really struggle with answering is their definition of a quote unquote good school. I think, Kirk, you said a decent school. And this is part of why I alluded to how there's a lot of emotions and values and egos, you know, because at the end of the day, I think most parents would say, well, I want my kid to go to a good college and go get a good job, which is fair. But you can get a good job coming out of community college. You can get a good job coming out of a state public school. You can get a good job coming out of Ivy League school. That's true everywhere, up to the kid, of course. But so often, part of the challenge, and we saw this during the pandemic in terms of where people applied, is that, you know, there's sort of two truths, right? Number one, people equate price with quality. So the higher the price, the better the quality, which isn't always true, but that's how a lot of people think. And number two is, in the absence of other information, you're going to go with what you know, which is, I don't necessarily know XYZ state school is a good school, but I know Harvard's a good school, right? Because everybody says so. So I'm just going to try and aim my kid at Harvard. When you ask parents, like, well, what do you actually want for your kid? What do you actually want for your kid to get out of college? They can't address it. And so all they know is eventually translate to, well, my kid has to go to Harvard to get a good job, which just simply isn't true.
In our last few minutes, you know, best advice for people who are trying to plan for college. Barb, I'm going to go to you first.
I keep thinking about what makes a successful adult, because your goal as a parent is that you want to create an independent and successful adult. Clearly, in many cases, college is a part of that. But I think it goes into an entire philosophy of parenting, which is you want to give your child enough experiences so that they are able to make decisions on their own. You want them to be able to evaluate information and choose a path for themselves. And so instead of looking at college in and of itself, but look at it as one step in the development of your parenting job. And look at it, I think, today more creatively than ever. There are many ways that you can help your child go from 18-year-old into adulthood. A typical four-year college may be a part of that. Technical school may be a part of it. A gap year plus other alternatives may be a part of it. So broaden your thinking a little bit on the topic and then make a choice that seems right for you and your child and your family. So I am Barbara Friedberg. You can find me at Barbara Friedberg Personal Finance, Robo Advisor Pros, and on YouTube. Thanks for having me. See you next week. Bye.
Thanks for joining us, Barb. How about you, Kirk?
Barb stole a lot of my thunder. I think that what's important when you think about colleges for your kids is not think about what other people think is important, because every child's different. And you want your child to be successful in life and happy in life. And I think a lot of us parents get a little hyper-focused on making their child the best and to succeed. And rightfully so. It's a competitive society and it's only getting more so. What's important is taking a big step back and thinking about your child and think, what is going to be the best path for my child to be, I don't want to say the most success, but to be in the best position for success in whatever that means for them. For some kids, that might mean going to college. For some kids, it might mean not going to college, maybe a trade school, or, you know, maybe taking a gap year. Try to think outside the box. Don't just think about this as every kid goes to college. My kid needs to go to college. I need to follow the path. I need to, you know, keep up with the Joneses. Try to think a little bit outside the box and think about, you know, what's the best for your child. At the end of the day, that might mean going to college. And that's great. But I think every kid's different. And, you know, trying to fit him into a box is probably the wrong way to look at it. So taking the time to be mindful about the process. I know Jack is really good at this sort of stuff. I mean, we work with Jack a lot with clients. And there's a certain level of mindfulness needs to be put in this process. And it's challenging. It's overwhelming. There's a lot of information. It gets more overwhelming and everyone's hyper-competitive about it. But just try to take a huge step back and really just kind of take your time with it. Start early too. That's one thing that Jack has told me time and time again is start earlier. Because, you know, once you kind of get into the later stages of the game, there are just fewer choices available to you to make. Those are my thoughts for this week.
You give the last comment of the panel. So what's your best advice here?
My best advice really is in the college planning process, much as Kirk and Barb have alluded to, it really starts with the parents. What are the parents' expectations? Their definition of a good college or a good outcome, which sometimes is formulated based on their own college experience, you know, and understand their kid and their parenting style. Financially, you know, it's not just a matter of what can they afford. What are they willing to afford, especially if they have multiple children? I mean, you can't pay, you can't say, I'll pay $80,000 a year for one kid and $5,000 a year for the other. I suppose you could, but most families probably say that's a little unfair. But it really starts with the parents and looking at themselves and what they want, because for right or wrong, there's a lot of ego soothing. So as much as parents want their son or daughter to go to a good school, you know, to an Ivy League or whatever, parents will never admit it, but I will tell you, Megan, from experience, a lot of it is soothing the parents' ego so they can brag at Thanksgiving dinner time. And if that's really important, then fine. But if that's what it is, understand it and call it out up front and at least be conscious about it. But that goes again back into sort of the definition of a good school. So if parents figure that out first before you start pushing your kid down a path.
Well, Jack, we really appreciate you joining us today. And Barb and Kirk, it was great having you on. And Kirk, I'm going to pass the baton to you right now for you to wrap us up.
Thanks, Megan. And thanks for Jack and Barb for joining us as well. That's the show for this week. Thank you again for joining us in Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, Wealth Manager of Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on the podcast app of your choosing. So you can check out the show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to the show notes, resources, and the archive shows. We're going to try to add a little extra to the show notes for this because I know there's a lot of resources that will help our listeners when it comes to college. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.